dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm your guest host, Kyle Scheidler, Director of the Threat Information Office at the Center for Security Policy. I'll be filling in for my boss, your host, Frank Gaffney, as we conduct this intelligence briefing in the latest in the war for the free world.
Let's get started right away. A massive cyber attack on Friday broke out across the globe. Dozens of countries affected. Thousands of users facing a ransomware called WannaCry. As many as 200,000 computers affected. People locked out of their data unless they pay the cyber thieves what they want. How do we deal with these cyber threats, and how can you protect yourself? To discuss this, joining me now, Mike Daltrey, author of Devil Inside the Beltway, the shocking expose of the U.S. government surveillance and overreach into cybersecurity, medicine, and small business. He's a senior writer for Cyber Defense Magazine and just the man to talk to on this subject. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here, sir. How are you?
I'm very good. So far, my computer is not affected, so we're able to do this show. But talk to us a little bit about what WannaCry is, how it works.
Well, it really starts with the fact that it was a backdoor vulnerability created an opportunity to create WannaCry, which is really what we would call it, a ransom worm. It can infiltrate your network if you have the stage set by not having your Windows operating system updated, so that the backdoor is still open. And then if it'll promulgate throughout your network, if you inadvertently open something or click something, and it will freeze your files and immediately default into saying time to pay to play. You know, the thing about this is we don't have to be a computer expert to use our computer, but we do need to know basic hygiene to be proactive, because we can't know everything that's going wrong, all wrong in cyberspace. I mean, you could argue the original sin here is in two places. It's with the NSA somehow, some way, demanding to have these back doors open, and then being vulnerable as having this information taken and then being published so that the vulnerability was announced. And then you could point a finger maybe to the manufacturers, Microsoft, because they stopped supporting older legacy operating systems, and you could say it's to, you know, force you to start using the newer stuff. But that's not so great when something like this is all over. So they have, the second they understood about what could happen, they put automatic patches within their automatic updates for the newer systems, and they put a patch out for like XP or Windows 2000, but you had to know to go get that. So, 200,000 sounds like a big number. It could have been way, way, way worse, because there's millions and millions of machines out there. But, you know, it just shows how close and interrelated we all are all over the world. It's been an amazing fire drill and quite a lesson.
So one of the things that's noteworthy, I think, about this incident is how global it was in scope. We have machines in China, machines in Russia reporting the ransomware. The NHS in Britain reportedly affected. What do we know in terms of attribution? Do we know who's responsible for this?
Well, the fingers have been pointing to North Korea the past 24 hours. It seemed, who wants to be a world troublemaker? This was not, who knows over time? I don't work for government investigators, so, my guess is based on what I see in the press, and it still is just an educated guess. However, one thing to note about this is petty thievery and a global harassment. It was not, attacking a political stage. It just went after everybody. It didn't go after a specific country or anything like that. It was just, it does fit with North Korea, who seems to have this insecure need to have their presence known, and wants to just be a fly in the ointment, as they were within the Sony hack. But we don't quite know yet. But it does also show how small a world this has become. And I can't wait to see the data on how many legacy systems really were involved in this versus the more newer Windows operating systems and the health of those local economies. Why was the British health care system the first to get hit? Did they not update because of money? Did they not have the requirements? Did they not have the training? Or was it because they had complex software that you could only work with older systems? I mean, there's many reasons why people have older systems and don't auto update, and some of them are not to be criticized. So I can't wait to see the real specifics once we have more time to analyze.
One of the things I think that's interesting about the interconnectedness is it also leads to there being no one really to say, okay, the buck stops here and this is our responsibility. You have Microsoft President Brad Smith apparently blaming the National Security Agency for having this exploit unplugged. But as you pointed out yourself, Microsoft does not go entirely blameless. In terms of the national cyber infrastructure, how do we look at figuring out this public-private partnership in terms of who to hold responsible when something goes wrong?
Well, you said two important words there, like partnership and responsible. And it's funny because I'm at the Global Summit right now in London, and that's what we're talking about just this morning. As we're going to go from blame, or are we going to be partners? This is an early growing revolution in technology. It is going to be just normally erratic. Going for the blame game hurts really cross development and trust. You can't legislate trust. You only have to earn and develop trust. So if the government wants to work on making people better without blame, you will see a pattern of many more people coming forward proactively to discuss the weaknesses. Europe seems to be farther ahead than the United States in doing this. The United States is all about bully regulation and head on a spike, and then other people within, the community, like Microsoft, blaming. And that, in my estimation, was a very good offense to play defense. or say good defense by playing offense, because look, there's no one that's totally blameless, but we have to look at where we are in the big picture. And honestly, this thing has been on its own. It's just, technology and the internet is an unwieldy beast at this point, and mistakes can be made, and it's not going away. And, hindsight is always clear as a bell. And I think we just never paid enough attention to security at the root level. And security at the root level would start with the hardware and software vendors.
You mentioned this revolution that we're looking at. And of course, things are only going to get more complicated. They're talking about the Internet of Things. Are we looking at a world where I may have to pay some black hat hacker in Russia in order to use my ice machine on my refrigerator? What's the end state here?
Well, that's an interesting point. And we actually talked about that this morning as well. Social pressure to make sure that your product is safe before it leaves the factory, and market pressure is where that's going to have to come from. And it'll happen. I mean, there now is, billions on the table in business opportunity to be made by solving these problems proactively. And once that gets done, I mean, I truly believe this will be an unfortunate chapter, but it will close. We're just behind in the security vulnerabilities because we didn't pay attention to them. I mean, what used to happen, Microsoft included, is we'd just, get it. Customers would want it fast, toss it out there, and then you'd find out what was buggy and you'd fix it. Oh, well. But, once it hit globally and all these bad guys are out there and you're talking big cash, it's a different story. And, again, this is an interesting this is an interesting example how more intertwined we are. It's just, you know, this is a tiny world right now. And honestly, I think we're lucky we didn't get worse off.
Well, Mike, on that cheery note, we appreciate your assistance in helping us walk through this. Thank you very much. That was Mike Daughtry of Cyber Defense Magazine talking about the ransomware WannaCry. And we appreciate you weighing in here on Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm your guest host for today, Kyle Scheidler. Joining me now is Ned May, the proprietor of the Gates of Vienna blog, which is one of the best resources on the internet when it comes to understanding exactly what is going on in Europe right now. The refugee crisis and the populist reaction to that incident and general European Union overreach. Ned May just simply runs one of the best sites on the internet in terms of getting caught up for that. So joining me now, Ned May. Ned, thanks for coming on. Some interesting developments in Europe right now, particularly in Germany. Give us an idea of what's happening there.
Well, yeah, Germany looks like it's going to basically surrender to the immigrant wave. That is, there's no sign that there's going to be any major change, of course, the way there has been in Britain. But the topic you asked me about was the expropriation of private property housing to it by the government to house refugees. Hamburg is the specific place that just came up in the news. I believe Gatestone covered it. The thing is that they don't say we're doing this because of the refugees. They're saying that we need to free this housing up to be available for people who are on the market looking for places because we have such a crunch in housing. But everybody knows that the pressure on the demand pressure is coming from all these a couple million or so refugees that have been imported, and Hamburg has a lot of them. The law... There is an older law that said that the government could expropriate private property in the event of public danger or emergency, and it was changed in 2015 in the fall, right at the height of the crisis.
I'm here with Ned May of the Gates of Vienna blog, and we're talking about a situation going on right now in Hamburg, Germany, where the government is literally expropriating the private housing in order to reportedly house refugees. Ned, how is this situation being taken by the German public and the Hamburg public?
From what the Germans tell me, there is surprisingly little, even though everybody knows what's going on, there's surprisingly little resistance. The people who complain are basically called extremists or whatever, that they're by most people, even people who are aware of what's going on. That's why I say the situation in Germany appears so dire. It does not look like there's going to be a populist revolt against what's happening. Of course, it's still early. Germany is still prosperous, and that may not go on for too much longer, because one of the things that I've been looking at is the figures for how much GDP is being spent on those refugees, and it's taking a huge bite out of their social security, social services budget to do all they're doing for the refugees. So we'll have to wait and see, but right now, it looks like there's not going to be much of any resistance.
I think that's probably shocking to our American listeners you know, America really founded on the concept of private property and the idea that the government can't deprive you of it without due process. Is there anything like that in Germany?
Theoretically, it's private property, but Germany is a much more collectivist society. It's their mindset than we are. They, you know, the way we do things is considered appalling by a lot of Germans. You know, the free for all of the market, but it's a tradition that the state can do that, can expropriate for public need. What's different now is that officially, when this law was passed in 2015, the new law, it was because of the refugees, and it was the party that proposed it was the descendant of the Communist Party in the DDR, East Germany. I think they're called Linke now, or might be. Let's see, it's either Linke or Grünlinke. Anyway, they proposed that this law be put in, and specifically because of the need of refugees. And Die Linke, that's it, the left.
I think it's interesting you mentioned there's very little reaction, or at least not the kind of reaction that we Americans would expect from this event in Germany. But Germany is not the only European country dealing with this crisis, and not all European citizens are taking it lying down. There was an interesting case recently with a group of Italian activists that made an effort to block an NGO ship from, quote-unquote, rescuing migrants. Now, that sounds pretty horrific when you first look at it. But there's something more going on here. Ned, can you talk a little bit about, one, this incident, and then, two, what is the actual role that these NGOs are playing in the migrant crisis?
Well, that's a real can of worms you're opening there. After the initial phase of the migrant crisis, after the Balkan route was closed down and they started having to use the Mediterranean route instead, to expedite matters and make it more efficient, the NGOs, many of which are funded by George Soros, if you look them up and track them back, you can find the ownership and, you know, the foundations that fund these things. But these NGO boats go out, and they go they almost pick them up out of the surf in Libya. They go right offshore, and it's fairly clear that they're notifying the traffickers, the smugglers that people pay to get in their boats. They are notifying them, and they meet them just off the coast and transfer the refugees from one boat to another and take them to Italy. Presumably, they want to make sure that they get there alive and well and put them in the reception centers because they were tending to drown in those cheap, flimsy boats the traffickers use. So this was win-win from for both sides. The traffickers hardly have to do anything to get that big hunk of money, and then the people who want these refugees in Europe are getting them to port safely and processing them through the system.
Interesting. But recently, the Italian Identitaire movement made an attempt to stop one of these ships. How did that go?
Oh, the Coast Guard, I think it was the Coast Guard, intervened and stopped them. And it was the Italians and the Austrian Identitaires together. There are now, the ones that I'm aware of are the Identitaire movements are in France, Germany, Austria, Italy, and I believe there's one in the Netherlands. I'm not sure about other countries in Europe. And the Identitaire movement is, you know, in the press they're called white supremacists, but if you look at their videos and stuff, they don't seem that way. They're the resistance to the immigration and Islamization. They're one of the forms of the resistance, and they're mainly young people.
So they used their ship to try to block the NGO ship from engaging in this sort of human trafficking scheme disguised as a humanitarian intervention. Ned, we are out of time, but we really appreciate you coming on with us today to talk about the ever-evolving situation in Europe. So, Ned, thank you very much. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Joining me now on Secure Freedom Radio is Patrick Poole. Patrick is the National Security and Terrorism Reporter for PJ Media. He also happens to be, in my mind, one of the absolutely most knowledgeable people about the Muslim Brotherhood and the role the Muslim Brotherhood plays in terrorism. I consider myself no slouch in that regard, but Pat is truly one of the experts, and we're very happy to have him here on Secure Freedom Radio. Pat, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you recently began a series of interviews at PJ Media talking about the role the Muslim Brotherhood has actually played in real, on-the-ground terrorism in Egypt. You know, there's a debate in this country right now over designating the Muslim Brotherhood, and a lot of it has been from the 50,000-foot view. But you really have been on the ground in Egypt, digging under the rocks to figure out how the Brotherhood plays a role in terrorism in Egypt. And you recently had a very big interview at PJ Media. Tell me a bit about that interview and what you learned.
Well, Kyle, here over the past several years, I've been traveling to Egypt sometimes for a month at a time, meeting with experts, government officials, doing, you know, on the ground reporting from Upper Egypt and some other locations. And in this most recent trip, in fact, 2 weeks ago today, I sat down with retired Colonel Khaled Okasha, who used to be one of the top counterterrorism officials for Egyptian state security in the Sinai. And he retired about 6 months after Mohamed Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood president, came into power. And now he's the director of the National Center for Security Studies. So, I mean, he has been probably the most experienced counterterrorism official, former counterterrorism official in Egypt. And he saw the development of Jamaat Islamiyya and Islamic Jihad when he was stationed in Upper Egypt in the 1980s and 90s. He saw and has literally written the book on the development of the terrorist networks in the Sinai. And of course, now we have the Islamic State Sinai affiliate. And in this interview, we met twice, once for about 5 hours, and then for a three-hour interview on the record, which we're publishing at PJ Media. What he lays out are basically two fronts that after Mohamed Morsi was ousted from power in July 2013, the Muslim Brotherhood developed two fronts directly related to terrorism. And I think one of the most important and one of the most unexplored is the role that Mohamed Kamal, who was a senior Muslim Brotherhood leader, he was on the Guidance Bureau, basically their top, the top body in the International Muslim Brotherhood organization. He was the youngest member of the Guidance Bureau, and he was directly responsible for membership and the youth. Just days before the June 30th, the massive June 30th protests, that led to Morsi's ouster a couple days later, he was dispatched by the Brotherhood leadership to Azout, where he was from, in Upper Egypt. And from Azout, he developed, from his network of youth leaders, terror cells in all the governance within Egypt. And from that network, they began launching attacks on infrastructure, police, the military. But I what's most important about Mohamed Kamal is the fact that here we have a senior leader who was directly responsible for directing, organizing, and financing terrorism in Egypt.
And that's, I think, a very important point because, of course, we've had Muslim Brothers supposedly break off from the group and form their other terrorist organizations. But this is really one of the first cases where we have on record a high-level Muslim Brother being used the word dispatched, and I like it, being really dispatched to do this work, to create a network of terrorism that they could use to put pressure on the Egyptian government.
Well, yeah, and not only is he a senior leader, but as you pointed out, he was directed when the June 30th protests happened. It caught the Brotherhood entirely by surprise. Now, the June 30th protests in 2013 were the largest protests in recorded human history. 30 million people plus took to the streets of Egypt in opposition to the Muslim Brotherhood regime. And this caused a crisis within the Brotherhood. And it's in the midst of this crisis that Mohammed Kamal is dispatched to Azout to set up these terror cells that were intended to destabilize the regime after Morsi had been removed from office. The other thing that Mohammed Kamal was responsible for was for organizing the attacks on the churches and monasteries, which were happened all up and down Egypt, but were centered mostly in Upper Egypt, where the majority of the Coptic Christian population lives. And of course, the Coptic Christian population is the largest population of Christians in the Middle East. There are more Christians in Egypt than in the rest of the Middle East combined. And Kamal directed these attacks in April 2013 after the clearing of the Rabah and the Nada protests. And 6 months later, I was on the ground in Upper Egypt going to some of these churches and talking with the church officials who directly fingered the Muslim Brotherhood leadership in their various cities and villages for directing the attacks on these churches. So, and what Kamal was trying to do was to create a sectarian war in Egypt that would further destabilize the new regime.
And of course, the Islamic State has picked up the burden there, and you have a lot about in your current interview about how Islamic State Sinai came about somewhat through the machinations of the Brotherhood. But I wanted to quickly jump in on this question of the treatment of the Coptic Christians because of an interesting Twitter post which you caught from a former DHS advisor, a man well known to this program, Mohammed El Abiari. Tell us a little bit about what he said in terms of his views on the Coptic Christians in Egypt and what was happening to them.
Well, Mohammed El Abiari, who was a former senior advisor to Homeland Security in the Obama administration, has made a number of outrageous, bigoted, anti-Christian statements over the past several years. And when we see these attacks on Coptic Christians, El Abiari, who is an outspoken supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood, has basically taken to Twitter and said, well, you know, the Coptic Christians have it coming. He said it back in December with the church bombing in the cathedral compound in Cairo, where I just was a couple weeks ago. I was in that church that killed 29 people, all but one of them women and girls. And in that case, he took to Twitter, said they had it coming. And then the Palm Sunday bombings, which happened just days before I arrived in Cairo, that killed nearly 50 people, Again, he said, you know, what goes around comes around.
Unfortunately, Patrick, we are out of time. I really appreciate you joining me today. Everyone needs to go to PJ Media, and they need to read these interviews on the Muslim Brotherhood and their role in terrorism. So, Pat, thank you very much for doing that.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm your guest host for today, Kyle Scheidler, filling in for Frank Gaffney. Joining me now is Kevin Freeman. He's a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy. He's the author of Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack. He's also author of Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again. Founder of GlobalEconomicWarfare.com and the upcoming host of Economic Warfare, which will be on The Blaze coming summer 2017. Kevin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Kyle. It's good to be here.
So I want to get into a little bit more detail on this ransomware attack, WannaCry, affecting over 200,000 machines, a lot of people impacted, really across the globe. Some suggestion maybe North Korea is behind it. Is that a speculation that you put some stock into, Kevin, and why do you believe that?
Well, it's entirely plausible. Kaspersky Labs and Symantec have both pointed to the possibility that North Korea is involved. It looks like they're involved because the toolkits that were used were similar to those that were used to hack Sony. And North Korea may have been involved in the hacking of the SWIFT system that took $81 million away from Bangladesh and attempted to steal $1 billion. So it has all of the traits that it could be a North Korean operation, and that's very, very concerning.
Are the North Koreans interested in cyber warfare as a 21st century update to the old adage, you know, they rob banks because that's where the money is? I mean, is the internet just where the money is when it comes to this sort of attack?
We know two things about North Korea. One of them is they're desperately in need of hard currency. This is a nation that has been counterfeiting the U.S. dollar, $100 bills for decades. But we also know that they want a kill shot on the United States. That's why they've been developing nuclear weapons. That's why we can't let them get missiles that can reach the United States. That's why we're worried about EMP. So, yes, they need the money, and so they're going to the internet because that's where the money is. But number two, this is a potential kill shot on America, and they want to find it, and they want to, even if it means tearing down the world economy.
You know, we talk a lot on this program about the risk of nuclear weapons, and most especially about electromagnetic pulse and how that would be a kill shot on the United States. But talk to us about the economic kill shot. How could you use cyber warfare to get a kill shot on the U.S. economy?
Well, there are several means. One of them would be a cyber attack that took down the U.S. power grid. And while EMP is certainly a plausible and frightening scenario that it actually could work and take down our power grid, and we've got to defend against it, cyber means are also plausible. Ted Koppel wrote a book, Lights Out. So they could use the internet in the same way that the Iranians have tried with their Operation Cleaver when they tried to hack all of the major infrastructure of the country. So they could do it that way, but they could also do it just by collapsing our economy because we are so internet dependent. There are 200,000 computers that have been rendered useless from this ransomware because their files are encrypted in 150 countries. Just imagine if that were 2 million or 5 million. Just imagine the damage that would be if we don't have proper backups. You know, we don't have a national effort, which we need, to have an ability to protect, whether it would be from cyber storage that was guarded and protected or whatever. So much of our economy depends on this. You even have the example with banks where they could be hacked and you go in to find where the money is. It's all electronic and it doesn't exist anymore. And we can't find it. We don't even know that you have accounts there. These are very real concerns at the highest levels, and we don't have good answers for them yet.
It's kind of an inverse of the old view where the banks locked the money away. Now you're worried about the robbers locking you away from your money. And, of course, all computers are not created equal. So 200,000 computers, which may not be a massive number, if they're the right computers, the impact could be tremendous.
And some of our older infrastructure, for example, the transportation system, relies on these older computers with the older operating systems of Windows that have just never really been updated or patched because we can't bother with that. All it's doing is telling us the time schedules for airlines. Well, you could mess up the entire transportation system. You know, one snafu at United we've seen, and it grounds all their planes for an extended period. You have this happen across the board to all the major airlines. Just imagine the impact economically if all the airlines were shut down and it took weeks, if not months, to get back up.
Kevin, part of what you mentioned was the unwillingness to do the sort of updating and security consciousness that's necessary to protect ourselves and if we're in private industry, our companies. How does one go about making security consciousness economical? How do we convince the banks, the private companies, the stock market, that this is something that affects their bottom line? And if they don't do it, it will affect their bottom line in a negative way. How do we go about convincing them of that?
Well, the good news is a lot of the industries have recognized this, and we did this whole exercise with Y2K where we were worried that everything would shut down, the economy would collapse, and so forth. And so they did patches and consultants and all of the things necessary. And so you go to the banks, and they have very robust cyber capabilities. The problem is that they're protections are only as good as the weakest link. So you have one computer somewhere in the bank that has access to the entire network, and they happen to download a malware file, or they happen to click where they shouldn't click. And that has the potential to take down, you know, a huge – the banks are working on it. The major critical industries are working on it. The individuals, not so much.
One of the difficulties when it comes to cyber warfare is that a good defense only lasts for so long. How do we build in a cyber warfare capability that establishes some kind of deterrence? I mean, are we in a situation where the North Koreans can simply continue to pick at us until they hit pay dirt? How do we respond? How do we respond robustly in a way that suggests that state actors and non-state actors may not want to play around in this area?
Well, a couple of things. One is we need to get on a war footing. We need to realize we're in the midst of global economic war right now. And that's why, you know, that's my purpose in writing the books and the blog and the TV show Economic War Room is to prepare citizens. We're in a war now. And if you recall back, loose link lips sink ships. We have that same situation where you make a mistake on the computer and it could be translated 100,000 times over because of who you're connected to and people that trust you. And you know, it's like a pandemic. Once it's released out into the wild, you know, it has the potential to do enormous amounts of harm. Second thing is that we could make as a nation the intention that we're going to protect ourselves, like the moonshot, like Kennedy said, we're going to get to the moon. We could take, for example, Yucca Mountain and make it a mass storage facility for all of critical infrastructure and critical data. Third thing we could do is create a cyber castle doctrine where we allow if a company gets hacked, we release them to go back after the people who hacked them. And there's letters of mark and reprisal are mentioned in the Constitution. That's something that Congress could issue to very sophisticated companies when they see that they're being hacked, that they can go back and punish those who are hacking them. The problem is we don't really have a doctrine for how do we respond. When does it become an act of warfare and not just an act of criminal activity? Congress needs to step up and make clear how we're going to engage in this already existing war.
Kevin, a good point. And I think if the listeners of Secure Freedom Radio know anything, they know that we believe, along with you, that it's necessary to get on this war footing. And we encourage everyone to understand the ramifications of what's coming, especially in this economic space. Kevin, thank you so much for your time here on Secure Freedom Radio.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.